Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 2 and is titled Theology, the Art of Raising Questions. Let's listen in.
My name is Ann Peterson, and the title of this session is Theology, the Art of Raising Questions and Reflection on the Detail. Some faces I recognize from yesterday. Again, these sessions do not require back-to-back attendance or your participation in reading the entirety of Young Men in Fire, but I want to take just a few minutes to make some comments about where we left off yesterday as sort of a continuation into the material that I want to work with you on today. They had a little bit of a run on the book yesterday, so if any of you are still interested, they have some left. But Norman MacLean's book, Young Men in Fire, is the sort of the piece around which I'm building some of the ideas for the sessions this week. So again, if you're looking for a book to read while you're sitting staring at the mountains, this book is particularly apropos because it's about forest fires, in this case in southwest Montana, but the sort of reflections that MacLean does about the death of these young firefighters, I think fits the overall theme of this week, where in the world is God? We talked a little bit yesterday about the fact that this story started in 1949 with the death of these 13 young firefighters, and so MacLean's story is an attempt to sort through the questions and issues related to the tragedy of this forest fire. And underneath that layer of sort of detail, I think, is a strategy that MacLean's trying to talk about how we live in the midst of tragedy, suffering, and evil, and how we cope with that. So part of the session that occurs today is to look at, first, just very briefly, some sort of images from MacLean and a couple other pieces about how we think in the midst of tragedy and suffering. And I think we do that in a number of ways. We do it when we're in the midst of it, when you find yourself in the midst of a crisis and you ask yourself questions, or oftentimes what happens is later, after. You take time to think through the meaning of things. The events of the past few weeks with the Olympics and the TWA flight bring, of course, all kinds of questions to mind about how we think about suffering and tragedy and evil. In particular, we're asking the question, sort of a sustained question, about what do we do with God in the midst of all this? I want to give a couple images, and then I'm going to have you help me with some stuff on the board. I teach I haven't reintroduced myself again. I keep forgetting that some of you have just come in new again. I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I teach theology. Born and raised in Montana, but have been living in the Dakotas more recently. Another plug for Kathleen Norris. I keep saying, you know, these authors, but her books are sitting over in the bookstore, both The Cloister Walk and Dakota. And every year, we take turns in the department, and at first I dreaded teaching freshman religion. All students at Augustana are required. I was talking to two former Augie students, and some of you who go to private church colleges are required to take, you know, an introductory religion course. I'd say about 85 to 90% of my students don't want to be in there any more than I wanted to be in my freshman religion class when I was at Concordia. And I see these baseball caps pulled down over the heads with the crossed arms sitting in the back just waiting to see if they can survive a semester of religion. And our department has gone through a number of revisions with the course, and we've entitled it Exploring the Christian Faith. So I spend about the first few days talking with my students about what that title means. It's a very intentional title about how our department approaches the study of theology. In other words, God talk. How is it that we express our faith together? How is it that we talk about what we believe? One thing that you'll keep hearing me hammer on is that that Christians, I think, are called on to articulate their faith. Christianity can't sort of wall itself up. One of my biggest fears is that when the language of the faith becomes private only, then the faith loses its usefulness in the public arena. I think theologians, and I'm going to make a claim in a minute, that I think we're all theologians, academic, lay people, PhD or not PhD, we're all called upon to be theologians, which is those who are called to express your faith. So this course I teach, Exploring the Christian Faith, I use a metaphor that I want to share with you about what I think that means. How many of you have read Annie Dillard? Mm-hmm. Okay. One of my favorite authors, and I'm going to stumble on the title of the book. I think it's Teaching a Stone to Speak or Talk. Teaching a Stone to Talk. And she has these brief reflections that sort of weave in and out of the book. And at one point, I wish I had the quote with me, she talks about the experience of the Christian faith, and she said, if we knew half the danger of what it meant to be Christians, we wouldn't, as she puts it, we wouldn't wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to churches. Instead, the ushers would issue life preservers and they'd lash us to our pews. It's a wonderful image.
Helmets.
Yes, issue us helmets. Thank you. And she talks about the fact that many people approach their faith as if they were tourists on a package tour of the absolute. Okay? Many of us approach our faith as if we're on a packaged tour of the absolute.
Is that your term or her term?
It's her term. It's a marvelous term, and Annie Dillard uses this to talk about how passive most of us are when it comes to the experience of our faith. And I find that that's much the posture that my students come with into the freshman religion class. They want me to tell them what they need to believe in order to be Christian. That's what theology has meant for them. In order to be Christian, you recite certain beliefs. I don't know about you, but for me, confirmation wasn't the highlight of my life. I remember sitting every other chair during the 2 years, and our pastor at one point got so sick and tired of our class that for the rest of the year he made sure that we were allowed to raise no questions during the rest of the year. So we basically sat every other chair. I was spared the pain of memorizing the catechism. That came at seminary. But that sort of mentality, that what faith meant was in order to be confirmed you sat in a chair for 2 years and didn't ask any questions, learned what the pastor said, and then you became a real Christian. A lot of my students have still been trained that way. They come into religion class with a fear about questions, with a fear of even talking about their faith, because it's been instilled in them that what's important to them is that they have to believe a certain set of things. So faith becomes equated with right belief. And I think Lutherans are atrociously guilty of this. I think Lutherans have made belief sort of the test case of whether we're good Christians or not. Can you recite the catechism? Do you know everything for pastors? Have you read the Book of Confessions a million times, the Lutheran Confessions? Are you able to be a good Christian by what you believe? So these students in the freshman religion class have a hard time sort of understanding that when I mean exploring the Christian faith, what I hope will happen during the semester, and they get really exasperated with me during the course of the semester, I give them what I call them blaze marks through the course and let them weave their own theological viewpoint together so that by the end of that term, hopefully they'll have had lots of material for me, they'll have had textbooks, they'll have had discussions with other students. But finally, at the end of that course, my hope is that they'll have understood why they believe what they believe, instead of merely being able to sort of spew it out. So I talk about the faith being, exploring the Christian faith for me is less like, and hopefully Dillard is saying this too, less like a package tour of the absolute, and more for me like a backpack. I did a lot of backpacking both in Montana and Colorado, and in Colorado we spent a lot of time above tree line. A lot of the area was in tundra, and if you come across, you know, there's no blaze marks, so they used the cairns, the pile of rocks, and many times those were difficult to find. You go from one blaze mark to the other. We spent a lot of time with compass and map and hoping you ended up on the right part of the tundra. And that's a little bit what I hope happens for the students in my freshman religion class, is that they're turned loose, sort of rootless for a while, that they have trouble finding the blaze marks. Maybe by the end of the course, they've discovered a new trail, but they're going to have to learn how to put the pieces together themselves. And I think, at least from my own upbringing, theology has often been this equation of doing it, believing the right thing. Just from your experience, how would you define that word? Who or what is a theologian?
The street people of Washington, D.C.
Okay.
That's been my experience.
Do you want to say a little bit about that? I mean, give an example.
Well, I think of the elder men, African American men, who sit in the fences in community,
okay,
together day after day. They know what life is like. They know the reality of
And you said what life is like. So it's a reflection from the street. It goes back a little bit yesterday to McLean's comments, reflection from the ground up, isn't it? What else comes to mind? When you think of a theologian, who or what do you think of? Yes.
To me, it's someone who's in his head.
Okay.
In relation to God.
Okay.
And because that person's in his head so much in relation to God, after so much study, he might have less of a faith rather than more.
Okay.
Because the real relationship to God, or the study of God, ultimately, I'm not saying that isn't important.
Right.
Ultimately, I believe is an experience. It's a profound experience, which involves you totally and changes your life.
And not just a head.
It cannot be what you believe. It is. And this is why God, the I Am, says, I am.
There's a lot of sort of interesting literature done, and I'm going to have to collect the title of the book for you. Our campus pastor does a survey. We do a spirituality sort of survey with my students, and there's a certain book out where you check A or B, all these kinds of things. And it turns out that somebody has sort of mapped out four spirituality types. And one of them is intellect. One is sort of an experiential component. One is those who end up reflecting more on the inner life, and those who end up doing more active ministry. And the point of the thing is that some of us are oriented a certain way, but all components need to be fully integrated into one in order to experience. And you can see in the tradition, and interestingly enough, this man puts Lutherans here. I mean, that's not saying all Lutherans are there, but typically if you look at the Lutheran legacy of theology, starting with Luther, most of our work has been a commentary from then on, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries. Did you have something to
add? I've talked and
okay.
I'll wait.
Okay. Other comments on what a theologian is or who a theologian is?
Maybe children are sometimes theologians.
Okay. Yes. They ask a lot of great questions, don't they? Yeah. And sometimes, thankfully, the most obvious one.
Dr. Haar was certainly asking questions.
Yeah. One of the faculty at Augustana, Murray Haar, talks about the fact that being a theologian is asking or living in the questions.
Yes. From some of my experience at seminary, it has seemed that theologians are people that are making sweeping generalizations or trying to make a truth claim about something that they really don't have a lot of knowledge about, yet are very certain that what they know is true.
Okay.
Wow. A package deal through the package tour through the absolute.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, I used to sit at seminary, and half seminary was sort of over here on one side. I was at Luther for a while, and sort of the Spolenheim Snook crowd was over there, and the Ferdy crowd was over there. And somebody actually had the gall to tell me that I didn't know this, and if I really did, I wouldn't be studying with the people I did. So, you know, I think this is a really interesting comment.
Wow.
We often equate theology with having the truth, don't we? Especially, it's usually not a little truth, it's
the
truth. And if it becomes equated with the package tour of the absolute, it becomes the absolute truth. So theology becomes an acquisition of the truth. And it becomes very difficult, and I find for a lot of us, and I'll put myself in this mode, it becomes more frightening to talk about theology as conversation about truths. As if we don't know yet that maybe this is something we have to work through.
Right.
But I think theology has often acted as if whosoever perspective really knows what the truth is, doesn't it? Yeah.
Live in the study of God, who truly knows God? And there's a continual asking and searching about who God is.
Okay, so there are limitations on our knowledge, aren't there? Because of the object that we're studying is also the subject of our faith. And that's always sort of an entertaining idea to me, that the object of our faith is the subject, I mean, the object of our study is the subject of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
When you get right down to it, I think theologian has often been a product of the academic. I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I wish we could get to this point more. Where theology, and I want, and this is where I'll push this session, is from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's telling the story. Mm-hmm. It's telling the story of God's people,
mm-hmm.
as we know it in Scripture,
yeah.
as we know it in our own life. Right.
And
a theologian isn't one who just stands up and tells that story. But we are all theologians because we are all part of that story.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think that's a claim, that's a responsibility of being a Christian, is being a theologian. But I think it's like a lot of things, we've left it up to the academics. It's very much the situation I think about in medicine. I'm speaking with a doctor, so my glasses are so dirty I can't see where everybody is, but you know, I think we think about that, or have thought about that way about medicine. You'd go to the doctor, and whatever the doctor said, clearly they had the pile of degrees on the wall, and they knew what was wrong with you, and you rarely questioned. And that's sort of been the old model of medicine. And yet in healthcare, there's a radical, I think, revisioning. When I go to my doctor now, she's very different. And we sit down and talk about what's going on and what the processes are, and encourages me to look up things and read things and be responsible for my own health. And often theology, I think, has been left to, I hear a lot of seminary students and pastors say, I don't want to raise those issues in my congregation because the lay people can't handle it. I think that's one of the most insulting kinds of things that can happen, as if to presume that the claims of the faith are somehow only belong to certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think there's a real fear about being a theologian. Because if you start examining your faith, questioning it, struggling with it, don't you find yourself changing sometimes or wondering if what was rock bottom foundation may the next day be swept away? I mean, I don't know about you, but some of my introductory courses in college, and particularly at seminary, a lot of foundations that I thought were true got swept away. That turns in the long haul. I'm glad they got, well, it's a nice washing away of some things that didn't. But there's a fear, and I sense that fear a lot in my students. What if Adam and Eve aren't real people? You know, we'll get into this whole question about the Genesis stories or whatever, and just things like biblical authority. How am I, and then they make the next leap to, well, if Adam and Eve weren't real, then that means Jesus wasn't. You know, you can sort of see the incredible sort of panic about exploring what it is they believe. So I think at one end it's really nice to talk about asking questions, telling our stories, so on. But when you really get down to it, there is a great element of risk. When you approach the Christian faith from that direction, then if you approach it from the understanding that what faith is about is simply rendering answers. Okay? Any other comments before we go on about who or what a theologian is?
I kind of get the idea that we're talking about middle management theologians, because it's hard for me to imagine somebody like Kierkegaard or, well, he's the only one I can think of, but Martin Buber in more modern times. And who's your favorite, Bill?
Bonhoeffer.
I can hardly imagine those people fitting the description of thinking they have the heart, the corner on the market. Mm-hmm. So it sort of feels like we're talking about middle-level management. And I like your idea of the, it fits my model mm-hmm. for a physician to be a partner with their particular patient or client or whatever you want to use. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea that we can talk eye to eye with people who are theologians and we can do that.
I think that's a really helpful comment because, I mean, Bonhoeffer's a great example of somebody whose theology would clearly not fit having a corner market on the truth. In fact, if anything, he spent much of his time sort of repudiating what he called the God of traditional theology. Mm-hmm. I just taught Letters and Papers in prison again. Familiar name to everybody, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. Reread Letters and Papers again. I haven't picked that up for a long time, and there's sort of a resurgence again in Bonhoeffer studies. We had an opening in our department this year in ethics, and nearly every candidate we interviewed was doing work in Bonhoeffer, many doing their dissertation on Bonhoeffer.
By the way, I should retract something. I really didn't mean to insult middle-level management. maybe I should say the wannabe theologians.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I think part of it comes back to this issue of truth and the fact that I think part of it's also our education system. I mean, it's very clear that by the time, in order to teach theology in an institution, you go through how many different degrees and languages and PhDs, and it becomes a very specialized focus, and then you spend, you know, I spent 1 year writing a dissertation on one very small piece of Luther, and I think, but that's not unlike the rest of our educational system. It's become very compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing about being a theologian that I think is very powerful about McLean, is the connection that if you start here, back to where Mary said, back to where McLean talks about, if you start from the street, what you believe has to be related to the place in which you live.
Right.
No question.
And yet, so often, and maybe this is the middle management theory of theology, we end up starting abstractly. And the more I think about that, the crazier that kind of theological thinking has become for me.
Right.
That we spend a lot of time in sort of abstractions. And I think Luther's profound about this, what happens is that theology begins in the concrete data of our lives, and the experiential components and those messy street conversations where we know what reality is and what we know what life is like. Those are marvelous definitions for me of what theology is about. because there, theology becomes an embodied experience, and at least Christologically, which is where we're going to keep pushing probably on Thursday, I think theology then becomes much more interesting. Yes?
I think sometimes we get involved in the process. Mm-hmm. In how do you sing, how are you allowed to sing this type of song, just what it should the liturgy be like. And that becomes the theology.
Sure. Yeah, anything that sort
process.
Of... the process or the correctness of something,
yes.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I have read, and this was striking to me, that we do ethics, we do theology.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about that? I mean, and that just struck me, and then I realized the things I had thought of theology as truth, or the study of truth,
mm-hmm.
and then I began mentally to think, no, there's dogma, you know,
mm-hmm.
versus what we do as embodied experience.
I'm going to talk in just a little bit about the different kinds of theology. I think even that's helpful to know about. But liberation theology has had an ongoing reminder that theology is integrated with doing, with praxis, so that theory and practice are never separated. A marvelous quote, and I wrote this down, it's in a, as far as I can tell, it's in an untranslated piece of Luther. And this may catch what you're saying. Luther says, theology is not about speculation or reading. It's not only about speculation or reading, but also about living and dying and being damned. That's Luther. Most of Luther's theology arises out of pastoral or political or social questions.
Hmm.
What do I do about the peasants? What do I do about... volumes and volumes ranting and raving against Zwingli about the sacraments. What do I do about the issue of usury? What do I do about the issue of whatever? And it's from that place then that Luther begins to reflect, always in conversation with, but not beginning from up here. In fact, we'll get into this tomorrow, his biggest critique of some of his components is that they begin up here, both Christologically and theologically. And I think what Luther tried to advocate is a theology, again, he says this is not only, and yet it's important that the speculation and that the reading and that the thinking it occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like the sciences. It's very important that both theory and the, you know, the practice of the science work together.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, during the Middle Ages, theology was known as what? The queen of the sciences. So if you look back to the practice of the scientific method, especially in medieval science, it's interesting to see theology, it no longer holds that place, but for centuries it was known as the queen of the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down just another couple of quotes about what theology is. Again from this book by John Cobb, Becoming a Thinking Christian. Theology is an invitation, he says, to become aware of the beliefs by which you live and to think about them. Fairly straightforward statement. Theology is an invitation to become aware of the beliefs by which you live and to think about them. That means that it invites you to become aware that you are already a theologian and to become a good one. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Think about some of the issues that have arisen, and we're going to take a little time at the end to go through some of these questions. Think about some of the difficult issues about which you have to make decisions. Cobb is saying that becoming a theologian is raising to awareness what you already believe and then thinking about it. Okay? Then from Kathleen Sands, the woman whose book I mentioned yesterday, Escape from Paradise, she's particularly commenting on how theology reflects on the nature of tragedy. How do we think about God's presence in the world of suffering and evil? She says, in commending theological attention to the tragic, I am proposing a style of theology that is founded more on questions than on speculation or doctrinal claims. It's a little bit like Luther, isn't it? I suggest a theology that is based on questions more than on speculation or doctrinal claims. Tragedies foreclose the faith that forecloses questioning. Instead, they find every form of conflict and suffering question-worthy and wonder-worthy. So what she's saying is theology is about this process of raising questions to consciousness and letting us live in the tensions of those questions. I think it's a shift in piety. Somebody used that expression with me, and I think that's helpful. It's a shift in piety about what theology is. I think, again, from my background and what I see with a lot of students, theology has been the business of the church to give answers, to make us feel good, to tell us what we believe so we don't have to think about it. I even think about the process of sermons. Mm-hmm. How many sermons do we sit through week after week in which you're sort of just, it's a very passive process, at which sometimes you're really told what to believe about a certain thing. Those are the ones I usually nap in. Same when I can always tell when I'm losing it with my freshman religion class, because slowly the eyes are rolling and the hat's pulled down, and you know that what you've done is disengaged the mind. But I think it's a shift in piety. Theology has often been about the business of answer giving, premature answer giving. Not saying eventually that one doesn't move to that place. But I think if you ignore the place from which you start, which is what Mary challenged us to do, the street, if you ignore the place in which you live and the details of the experience of the faith, wow, you're going to lose, I think, the whole purpose of what Christian theology is about. Okay?
I think it's intriguing. I talked a little bit this morning about just thinking about Bible study. Mm-hmm. And that in Bible study, that people come with questions. Mm-hmm. But, and then there's so many questions. But then I think there's an expectation of the leader of the Bible study to know the answer.
Yeah. Isn't that true?
And there's that expectation, there's a goodness in that the questions are coming. Mm-hmm. But then it's the process by which we engage in one another.
Yeah.
But it isn't just question and answer, mm-hmm, but it's question and question and question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good segue into what I think theology has often been, coming with the questions and hoping you find the answers, isn't it? And part of that is going back to this notion of the truth. That what you really want to do is find out the truth. And maybe once you'll go to a Bible study, and there are denominations and groups that function that way. Now, I don't think that that's an unusual thing to expect. I think it's even more unusual to talk about theology as a conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In search of the truth. And maybe in search of beauty and goodness. This kind of comes back to the comment that faith is not just a head experience. It's not just about truth as an intellectual. Truth is also the way we live, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So that the Christian faith becomes more than, again, this content-driven, but becomes a conversation or a process by which together we discover what the faith is about.
Will you be talking about how Jesus used questions?
Well, I mean, I hadn't planned on it, but I think that's a way that
this
you
is where Mark comes about the Jewish, yeah, background.
Sure.
To understand God was asking, mm-hmm, questions.
Sure.
We talked for 2 hours on why do you say that, yeah, call me Lord and don't do what I, yeah, tell you to do. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's true. There's this, I mean, it's built into the same with the process of questioning of Job, of the lament psalms. I mean, there are many examples in Scripture in which people argue, talk about. And of course, one of my favorite renditions of the Genesis story is that Eve is the first theologian. Right? She's the one that argues with the serpent. Adam, who was supposed to have been the spokesperson for the family, is hiding out in the bushes. So, you know, it's a wonderful commentary. Some of you have read a woman named Phyllis Trible. A book, I'll have to get the title through my head, got something about the rhetoric of sexuality. Just this marvelous commentary about Eve being the first theologian and the women being the first preachers, right? Those who carried the word from the tomb. But I think that's a marvelous sort of twist on the Adam and Eve story, that it's Eve who becomes the first theologian because she struggles with the questions about God and sin and then engages in this conversation.
Well, that's that shift in piety that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's really a shift of perspective, isn't it?
Yeah.
About looking at what theology means. Mm-hmm. Any comments or questions? I just want to make a brief sort of aside about the different kinds of, and I'm not going to take much time on this, but I think this is sort of helpful. Theology comes in many different styles. You were just talking about biblical theology, and of course, the seminary is broken down into these different sort of things. It's a reflection on the lives, the stories, the scripture that marks. I mean, I think of people who spend their whole lives studying scripture and the reflection on the conversations that come out of the stories that mark our lives from scripture. Another type of theology is what I would call historical theology. Reflection on the tradition. I mean, what has happened in the faith? For instance, you can get your PhD in Reformation history and know everything there is to know about, say, Martin Luther. So that's a historical tradition, and I've heard a nice phrase, it's an examination of the living tradition. It's not as if the Christian faith is some sort of dead deposit of material, but it's the unwinding of who we are. Being one who didn't particularly like this, I waited to take all my history courses in seminary until the very last minute. What I grew to love about history was that you understand where you've come from. And that's, again, part of this process of asking the questions and examining the detail. When you realize that the beliefs that you've inherited come through this long process. It's a living engagement back and forth between the texts of the faith and the context in which we live. That's another way of talking about theology, is that it's a text context. It's this correlation. Mm-hmm. Paul Tillich, some of that language sounds familiar to you. It's this conversation back and forth between the texts of the tradition, scripture, theology, and relating it always to the context in which you live. One of the best examples that I'm trying to work with now in this is the issue of religion and science. How do we make our faith intelligible in a world that's marked primarily as a scientific and technological age? Why is it that we never hear any sermons from the pulpit on Sunday morning about genetic testing? I mean, that sounds, you think, well, why would I want to hear that? And yet, the kinds of issues, the Lutheran just had a recent little blurb on what's happening with genetic testing. And if you think about the incredible decisions that the church, that we're facing with the ongoing discoveries, and yet how often do we take time to think about how that impacts our faith? Are we going to make those decisions just sort of blindly? Or are somehow we called to make what we believe relevant to and engaged in the context in which we live? Another type of theology is what I would call confessional. How many of you were Lutheran? How many of you have read the Book of Confessions? Okay, a few of you. Okay? The Bekenntnisschriften, the good old book of confessions from which we believe, most of which were written by whom? Not Martin Luther, right? Philip Melanchthon. So it's always interesting that when we talk about being Lutherans, most of the writings that we understand our faith to be about are not written by Luther, they're written by Philip Melanchthon. Confessional theology means to take a look at the statements of belief and reflect on those. And Lutherans particularly are marked as a confessional community. We have this thick book of things like the Augsburg Confession, the Schmalkald Articles, the Large and Small Catechism. Those writings that have marked the boundaries of what it means to be Lutheran. And yet most of the time I do adult forums in Lutheran congregations, about 90% of the congregation has never opened the Book of Confessions, and I don't blame that on the congregation because most of the pastors haven't opened it against the seminary. So it's a time to look at how you understand your faith. Another kind of theology is what I would call dogmatic. That is looking at certain dogmas or doctrines, examining, for instance, the doctrine of the Trinity, Christian anthropology, doctrine of God, and looking at how those relate together. And the last one, which is what I'm suggesting that we think about how we do, is constructive theology. That is building your own belief system. Mm. Becoming the architect of your own faith. When you construct something, right, you start from the ground up, you have a bad house if you start with the roof and hope it makes it to the ground. And yet, if you think about it, that's been one of my critiques about theology, is that often we start with a roof and we forget the support system underneath. You forget to start from the ground and build upwards. One of the best constructive theologians, I think, of this century of the Lutheran tradition, and also ecumenically Lutheran or not, is a man named Joseph Sittler. His books, Essays on Nature and Grace and Gravity and Grace, both of which are out of print. I don't know if the library has them up here. Any of you familiar with Sittler? Yeah, it's just marvelous, marvelous essays, where he talks about the fact that everybody is called to be a theologian and called to relate the ideas of their faith to the context in which they live. So if you have some time, pick up Sittler. I would think, I haven't checked in the library up here, but I can't imagine Holden wouldn't have some material of Sittler. Essays on Nature and Grace, and another little piece called Gravity and Grace. Sittler finally died, I can't remember what year, 1985, 86. He's a man in his late 80s. He taught for years at the University of Chicago Divinity School, and somehow his bathtub from his apartment ended up being the coat rack in the seminary hangout at LSTC, so his legacy lives on in a number of ways, but he's just a marvelous author that I would highly recommend looking at. So I'm going to suggest that theology is the art of asking questions and reflection on the detail. It's the art of asking questions. It's not merely that we just ask them, but it's formed into an art, and it's the reflection on the details of our lives. And as Mary said, this often comes first in the form of story. So theology becomes the art of asking questions and the reflection on the particular details of your life. I'm going to get back to MacLean for just a minute and share with you what I think. I know it's when it's hot and you're tired, listening to quotes can be rather tedious, but I want you to just listen to one where he talks about the art of as story as an art form, and particularly story as an art form as it reflects on the nature of tragedy. He's so much better at this than I am. He says as he's reflecting, even so, there may be somewhere an ending to this story that I'm telling. Although it might take a storyteller's faith to proceed on a quest to find it, and on the way to retain the belief that it might both be true and fit together. A story that honors the dead realistically partly atones for their sufferings. Okay? A story that honors the dead realistically partly atones for their suffering. You think about the Christian doctrine of atonement. What is the purpose of Jesus' death? That's a very interesting definition of atonement. It's to honor the dead realistically, not sentimentally, not covering over the tragedy, not wiping it away, not offering premature solutions, not saying, well, gee, it's too bad they died, they'll go to heaven anyway. It's nice, or sentimentalize the tragedy. Atonement has to do with honoring the dead realistically. And so he said that instead of leaving us in moral bewilderment, it adds dimensions to our acuteness in watching the universe's four elements at work: sky, earth, fire, and young men. Then he goes on, true though it must be, far back in the impulses to find this story is a storyteller's belief that at times life takes on the shape of art, and that the remembered remnants of these moments are largely what we come to mean by life. The short, semi-humorous comedies we live are long, certain tragedies, and our springtime lyrics and limericks make up most of what we are. They become almost all of what we remember of ourselves. Although it would be too fancy to take these moments of our lives that seemingly have shape and design as proof that we are inhabited by an impulse to art, yet with deep within us is a counter-impulse to the id, or to whatever name is presently attached to the disorderly, the violent, or the chaotic. As a feeling, this counter-impulse to the id is a kind of craving for sanity, for things belonging to each other, and it results in a comfortable feeling when the universe is seen to take a garment from the rack that seems to fit. It's a marvelous metaphor. He said there's within all of us sort of this two-sidedness, the experience of chaos and disorder and tragedy, and on the other hand, this craving for sanity. And it's a need to honor both. Of course, both impulses need to be present to explain our lives and our art, and probably go along to explain why tragedy, inflamed with the disorderly, is generally regarded as the most composed art form. Then just another little note about tragedy. He's talking again, reflecting on how the fire had consumed this crew, how fast it had moved up the valley. He says the fire had gained on the crew at every stage of the race until even the fastest had to fall. For a moment, only the four horsemen were higher up the hill and still alive, and only for a part of that moment would they see tragedy was among them. You can see tragedy coming from a considerable distance when you are older. I think that's true. At least the older I get, there are certain things, it has a different perspective. But when you are young, tragedy does not pertain to you and certainly never catches up to you. There are pieces of premonitions of tragedy floating around, but they do not yet add up to your tragedy. There are separate stabs of fear, of pity, of self-pity, but to a degree in separate parts of the body. Then suddenly they all merge into one sense, the encompassing sense of inevitability. It is everywhere on you as it becomes the essential whole of all that is preparing to be your tragedy. And of course, that's part of the pain of reflection, of beginning in the details, is that you can't avoid being implicated any longer. The nice thing is when theology approaches life from the distance, it's really easy to talk about suffering and evil or where God is in the world in an abstract way, because then it doesn't involve the implication of your own experience and your own beliefs. It's back to Annie Dillard's picture of the tour of the Packers tour of the absolute. It's much more risky to think theologically in an active, questioning, engaging kind of conversation. Just a couple things that I want to leave you with. Theology is the art of raising questions about God and the world, and the practice of reflection on the concrete data of our lives, This is the Ann Peterson definition of theology for interpreting the world in which we live and call creation. How do you respond to tragedy? I want you to think through these series of questions. I'm not going to ask you necessarily to share them with each other. But as we reflected yesterday on sort of the God problem, how do we talk about a good and all-powerful God, how we talk about the world in which we live in which there's so much pain and suffering and tragedy. I want you to think about these questions and about your own theological responses. I can't imagine that any of you haven't been caught in some situation in which you've had a tragedy occur and you've been the one that's had to respond to the person. What sorts of things do you say? What sorts of things go through your mind? Questions like, does what happens affect God? Does what happens to us affect God? And if so, what difference does that make to God? Secondly, a question that I think at some level seems rather obvious and yet I think is a dangerous question to ask. Does prayer make any difference in the world? Another Annie Dillard, one of my favorite illustrations of her, she said, we keep going to church every single Sunday and we keep hearing the same petitions and the same prayers. Lord, you know, we pray for so-and-so and so-and-so. And she said, finally one Sunday in her small congregation in Washington, the pastor just threw up his arms, looked up at the ceiling and said, I'm so tired, we keep saying these same prayers and we never get any answers. And then he went back to reciting the prayers. What difference does prayer make? For whom is it making a difference? There's a wonderful videotape of Joseph Sittler where he talks about prayer as a conversation with God, and often people in Scripture will pray for things and they don't get the results that they think they want. What's the point of prayer? Particularly in the case of tragedy, what are we praying about and for? What's the nature of our prayer? Thirdly, again, back to this reflection, how do you understand God? If you were to define good, how would you define God as all-powerful, as all-knowing, as all-good? We spent a lot of time yesterday on that. But just to reflect back, theologically, how would you answer those questions? Does everything that happens occur in accordance with God's will? Is there room for chance? It's clear, at least from my reading of what I've done in religion and science, a lot of theologians who are using religion and science talk about the fact that there is room for chance in the world, that what happens is often an occurrence or a mix of both law, natural law, and chance. Randomness, things happen randomly. How do you talk about the experience of a world in which randomness and chance occur, given the fact that we talk about God's will for the world? I think that's an interesting question. A friend of mine said that she heard of a doctoral dissertation that talked about the necessity for Christians to examine the issue of chance, of randomness. Why did somebody get cancer? Was it God's will? Maybe it was a random chance. A good friend of ours, about 2 years ago, he and his wife had just gotten married. They had just had a little boy. And he went in for an examination of an ulcer and came out with stomach cancer. How do we talk? No, the father. How do we talk about God's will? Most of us have been through these questions before. But the point of the session is maybe to start with this family situation and you reflect on what does it mean to talk about God's will in this kind of a situation? Does what appears as evil always result in some good? Does evil always result in good? One thing I've learned from my colleague Marie Haar at Augustana is that the Holocaust is a test case for that question. Can we ever say that any good has come out of that? Because it may do what McLean is so worried about. If we minimize, sentimentalize tragedy, we lose the acuteness of its horror. Right? Does God guarantee a positive outcome at the end? Will everything turn out okay at the end? In Christian theology talk, that's eschatology, to end things. How do you understand that? And does that make a difference in how you understand good and evil? And the last question, is God's relationship to us, how do you understand your relationship to God? Is God to you like a partner, a parent, particularly a father or mother, a king, a lord, a ruler? If so, does that change your theology? How do you even understand a simple question like, who is God for you? One exercise that I do with my freshmen a lot is I have them draw their image of God from what they thought it was like in childhood. We usually get some picture of an old man and a beard sitting somewhere up in heaven. And then they draw who God is for them now. More often it comes in much more sort of intimate expressions. So it's an interesting movement. Those are the kinds of questions. Yes?
I and my wife now lost our first mates in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask God a lot of questions. Why me, God?
Yeah.
Why wasn't it someone else? But it does bring your faith much stronger.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't? Or
it
does?
Does.
Yeah. I think...
If you win.
Yeah, if you win. Yeah.
Against yourself.
Yeah. I think the question asking for me has always been sort of inevitable. Probably the most painful question is, why me? Isn't that? I mean, I sort of told that ridiculous joke yesterday, but that's when pain can become so particularized. When you're face to face with your own tragedy, you can't help but reflect on the depth of that experience for yourself. And I think in the long haul, if you allow yourself to live in that, as you're saying, your faith can actually become strengthened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that the only way to get a strong faith?
You mean it's by questioning?
No, tragedy.
Oh, no. And in fact, I would say this week we're sort of talking a lot about tragedy, but it's very interesting that I think that in the end, and we'll talk about this on Friday a little bit, McLean's movement in the faith, part of the reason he sets out to tell the story of this tragedy is to give hope for the future. And one thing that happens out of this is that a lot of discoveries about science, the science of forest firefighting. I'm also one who believes that one doesn't have to live as if their life is one catastrophe after another, or that tragedy is the only thing that God gives us. In fact, very often, one of the best metaphors for faith that I love is sort of a paraphrased version of Martin Luther, which is, faith is trusting that you delight, that God delights in you. He uses the language of being pleasing to God. Waking up in the morning and looking in the mirror, can you say, boy, I know that I please God. That's an image that Luther uses for faith. Trusting that who you are, your own autobiography, is pleasing to God, that God delights in you. And he said that's one way to talk about faith. This is delight, that who you are is an expression. So in that sense, it's also, I think those sometimes, though, who are able to express the deep sense of tragedy are also the ones who can express the profound sense of joy. Because I think they're sort of kindred spirits at some level. That deep, profound joy that one experiences in life, I think, is often related to the ability to feel and to be aware of and to be in relationship with others. I have kept you as long as I am supposed to. You've been a very quiet and participant audience. I haven't let you say a lot, but I hope I wasn't overrunning you with comments. Just to let you know, on Thursday, for those of you who are around, we're going to look at a response. I've raised lots of questions in 2 days. Where is God? How do we talk about evil and suffering? I'm going to look at what I would call a strategy, not an answer, but a strategy of response. And that's, interestingly enough, for me, it's been found in Luther's little phrase, finitum capax infinity, the finite is bearer of the infinite. Mm-hmm. It's the earthly particular stuff of the world that carries God's grace, and particularly in Jesus Christ. And that's how we're going to look at sort of a response to this problem of suffering and evil. And then on Friday, look in a very sort of connected way about how for Luther that means a radical responsiveness to God, even to the point maybe of saying we become saviors of God. So we'll continue these conversations over the week. Enjoy your afternoon. I'll be around here for a few minutes if you have comments or questions for me, but enjoy your afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.